Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Packaging. It may be the biggest career area you've never considered. It's a $400 billion industry. And it includes jobs everywhere from the production line to engineering to management. And it's really changed in the light of Amazon and other online shopping. And environmental concerns have changed it. All kinds of things. Very interesting. One of this radio program's missions is to expose listeners to under-the-radar good careers. And packaging careers certainly qualifies. And well-qualified to talk about packaging careers is Sue Selke. She is director of the nationally prominent School of Packaging at Michigan State University. Sue Selke, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Terrific. Well, to an outsider like me, packaging seemed dull. I mean, just making bags and boxes. But as I started to learn about it, I changed my mind. Can you give me an example or two of not dull, perhaps innovative packaging?
Yeah, there's a bunch of examples. One of those is if you're buying acetaminophen or something like that for an infant or small child.
Tylenol. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. That the new packages now prohibit you from unintentionally giving your child more than the recommended dose. They dispense the right dose for you without you needing to measure it.
Wow. I had heard about the whole pharmaceutical industry. Older people have a lot of trouble keeping track of their multiple medications, and that there are all kinds of innovations in the way in which pharmaceuticals are packaged to avoid errors. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, there are, for example, special packages that your medications can be put into that will tell you when it's time to take a dose, that will record whether you opened it and dispensed the proper pill or whatever, and can even communicate that back to your pharmacy or doctor.
Wow. Now, there's a good example. I mean, that's a long way from, baby, we've come a long way from bags and boxes.
That's right.
Give me one more example.
Some of the examples that I think are pretty cool are relatively simple. I just had a company come in to show me some packets that they make for things like shampoo for hotels or even for food products like honey. And it's a simple little mostly paper package that instead of trying to tear open those
impossible to tear open those plastic things,
you just tear off the tab, squeeze it, the product comes out. But the cool thing is when you stop squeezing, it closes itself up again.
Wow,
so
right.
Use them for multiple doses, but they're really a very simple-looking little package.
You know what's interesting about that is, you know, for example, I'm at the risk of being too personal, I got some flea bites. It's a little out of season, but I got some flea bites, and so I used a little bit of hydrocortisone. But the regular standard, plastic squeeze tube, you can't control the right amount, so a little extra comes out, and what happens, you either waste it or you end up giving yourself an extra dose of cortisone for no good reason, and a packet like that that shuts itself off has remarkable potential benefits, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Right. So you see what I mean, dear listeners? Packaging is not dull, and it's a $400 billion industry. Now, I want to make sure one thing I don't want to do is be hypey. Really, no BS now, Sue. If someone is looking for a career, I'm not saying somebody who's going to be, on the assembly line. Generally, the people who listen to public radio and KELW in general are college educated. How difficult is it to get a good, middle class paying, stable, not offshoreable career in the world of packaging?
Well, it's so good that we can't admit to our program all the students who would like to study with us, because we just don't have the capacity.
That's not quite a good answer. I well know
so our employment rate is well over 90%. 90%, more over 95%.
Great.
These are professional jobs in packaging.
The reason I'm
comparable to engineers.
Great. The reason I'm sensitive to that is universities do a hell of a job of using statistics that make themselves look good but avoid the core question, how employable. Journalism schools talk about we're oversubscribed. Nursing schools say we're oversubscribed. Everybody's oversubscribed. Art schools say they're oversubscribed, and yet what percentage of them have stable middle-class incomes after they've incurred that six-figure debt? That's a statistic they're not so interested in talking about. Is that a fair criticism?
That's a fair criticism, and it doesn't apply to us.
Great. That's great, so that's why I pushed. All right. Now, especially here in the Bay Area, people... I want to get more specific about the job. What if I am your son or daughter... And I am in my 20s or let's say 30s or whatever, midlife person, even 40s. And I say, you know what? I've lived in the Bay Area. I buy the Bay Area orthodoxy. I'm an environmentalist. I hate Donald Trump. I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-this. You know, I have standard Bay Area values. Should I consider a career in packaging if I want a stable middle-class income, and if so, how?
You could absolutely consider a career in packaging. One of the things that many of our graduates look forward to doing is being able to make a difference in the considerations that are made when packages are designed so that they can be more environmentally friendly, for instance.
So give me an example of how a product that maybe in decades past might have been environmentally foolish, and now, either because of innovations or simply consciousness, what has changed? How has packaging changed to be more environmentally responsible?
A lot of it is the little things that you don't notice a lot. It's using less material to do the same job. So let me give you an example from the supermarket.
Right.
One of the products I buy is already grated cheese. Mm-hmm. And the... Within, I'd say, the past year, the pouch that cheese comes mm-hmm. in has gotten smaller. It still contains the same amount, but they were able to tweak the process.
Interesting.
So that they didn't have to use as much extra material. Because, you know, products settle after they're filled. So I don't know exactly what they did, but somehow or other, they managed to reduce the size of the pouch. And that reduces then the amount of material that's going into that pouch. It reduces the size of the corrugated boxes that are used to transport those pouches from, you know, the cheese factory to the supermarket. It has effects all during the supply chain. You need less fuel to run the trucks. So little changes like that, multiplied by millions and millions and millions of packages, can make a big difference.
How significant is the biodegradability of the plastics that are used?
Biodegradability is something that people tend to think is an automatic good thing, but when you think it through, sometimes it may be and sometimes it's not.
Interesting. I love surprising information. Tell me why biodegradability might not be a wise thing.
Well,
net.
In your area, for instance, you have a collection of organics for composting.
Right.
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a biodegradable packaging material that's, you know, let's say it's too contaminated to be recycled, but it could be composted, and there's a bit of difference between biodegradability and composting, but that gets maybe a little too technical. But in any case, if it could be composted, I don't have any way to get it composted. So it's going to go to a landfill if it doesn't get recycled, whether it's biodegradable or not.
Got it. So it adds cost without any real, you know, functional benefit. And again, is this really, you know, let's always look at environmentalism in terms of the largest context. How likely is it to affect climate change? How likely is the climate change, the number of degrees going up is likely to affect the humankind or animal kind or whatever? It's really important to always measure what is the net likely benefit relative to the human cost and fiscal cost. Is that a fair mm-hmm. summary?
Yeah, that is fair. And if you have to do something, say, to make something biodegradable that not only gives you more economic cost, but gives you more environmental cost because of the different things you have to do,
good point.
Then you may not have you may have a net negative instead of a positive.
Like electric cars. You know, electric cars sound like they're so clean, but they take a lot of energy to produce the energy necessary for the plug-in car. So it's really arguable how much energy saving, if any, that it may even be carbon neutral negative. But we're a little bit off topic here. So, but I want to make sure that we talk about specific careers, because that's what the show's mandate is. So again, I am your brother or son or daughter, and I'm interested in making a transition into a professional level, middle class paying job in this packaging industry that you say is so you know, robust. 90% of the people are getting employed. What are some of the more interesting jobs that you would encourage me to consider if I were your brother or, you know, interested in going in the field?
So help me out here a little. This is after you've already gotten the education that you need?
Well, let's start with that. How much education, you know, most people who are listening to this show are out of college. Many of them have college degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't in packaging science.
Okay.
So now what?
If they want to go into packaging, we do offer graduate programs. And we have a set of courses for people who don't already have education in packaging to get up to speed much more rapidly.
First question is, do you need that? I mean, one of my rules is that in general, 90% of people get into a field the traditional way, 10% don't. And if you're over 30, you're not so eager, especially if you've got a family and you've got mortgage and the rest of it, to go and spend all those huge bucks on going and getting a master's degree. If I have a master's in just some in business or in liberal arts or art therapy, am I doomed, or are the career, since you say the job market's so great, could I get a good job in packaging, or do I really have to go back to school, truthfully?
Well, the people who want to hire you want you to know something about the field. So unless you're already working for them in a technical type of field, I don't think you're very likely to get a job in packaging, because there is that specialized knowledge.
Okay, let's go. Go ahead.
You said not wanting to take on all that debt, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that a number of years ago we started an online master's program.
Oh, I see.
So people don't have to leave their current jobs.
Interesting.
Now, a lot of times these are people already working in a company. The company has moved them into packaging. They are supporting them in getting this extra education.
So let's go there for a minute. If I am, most of the listeners to the show live in California, and I know that I did a little research, and that Cal Poly San Luis Obispo is a program that has something there. And again, I'm worried about costs terribly. I see the amount of student debt, and it's the only debt, thanks to the damn higher education lobby, that makes it almost the only debt that cannot be discharged through bankruptcies. If you don't get a job, it ain't on the university, it's on you. So I'm very worried about costs. Mm-hmm. If I am this typical college graduate who does not have any degree in packaging, but I'm hearing about this great job market for people with some background in packaging, and let's say I was this very cost-conscious person, or even a cheapskate, what would you tell me to do to become hired, and then from once I'm inside, I'm able to move up?
Unless you have at least a technical background, I think you're fighting a losing battle to try to get to the end before you've gone through the pathway.
Okay, so let me loosen the strings. So now let's say I'm not being so tough, and I say, okay, you know, I'm not doing that well with my career anyway. I'm kind of intrigued by this packaging thing. I'm sort of technical by nature, but whatever. And I've got a bachelor's, let's say, in liberal arts, and I'm willing to put in the damn year or two or whatever. Do you tell me, I want you to put your stateswoman hat on now, not your Michigan State hat.
Oh, yeah.
Would you tell me to do your online master's program? And if so, in what particular, how would I tweak that to make me maximally employable in an interesting career? Would you tell me to do something at Cal Poly? Would you say, don't worry about it being a packaging program, go to some engineering? What would you tell me to really do?
I would say that if you've got a liberal arts background and you want a career in a technical field, you've got to first find a local community college or something and beef up your math and science.
Okay. So
step one.
How much math and science do I need?
You need the equivalent of a year of college physics.
Wow.
A year of college chemistry.
Jeez.
And some calculus.
Jesus. Really?
Yes, it's a technical field.
And do I use that stuff on, you know, I remember sitting on an airplane next to a guy who was an engineer at Raytheon. It's a major defense contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he doesn't use 98% of what he learned. He was required to take, and I myself, I have a PhD, and I was required to take 6 5-unit graduate-level statistics courses. I did not need, I have never, ever used a bit of it. How much of that physics and chemistry and calculus is, because that's the way universities run. These professors want to keep their jobs. How much is really necessary for the work of the typical bachelor's level person?
There's two ways to answer that. So thinking about this person who told you he never used most of what he learned, what he probably doesn't realize is that he learned the skills of logical reasoning, for instance, that math and science teach, and he learned to apply those to problem solving.
You know what? I'm going to fight you really, dog. Okay. There's a National Center for Teaching of Critical Thinking here in at Sonoma State University, and the data on the transferability of those generic science and math courses to the problem solving and thinking skills that occur in the real world is trivial. In the same way as Latin, which was presupposed to teach thinking skills, especially given the opportunity cost. Think of the amount of time and money that it takes to learn that calculus and physics, and was that, can that really be justified as the basis for making people take all that money and all that time for a really unproven amount of critical thinking skill increment?
But of course it is more than just the critical thinking skills. I can't imagine how someone could design a package to survive shipment through the distribution cycle if they didn't understand physics.
Right, and wouldn't that be true of only that small percentage of people in that $400 billion packaging industry who really do need to understand the tensile strength and physics calculus limits about, you know, optimizing strength versus light weight and all the rest of it? Sure, there's going to be a small percentage, but to get any professional-level job in this huge packaging industry requires that stretches credibility to me. Am I missing something?
So tell me what kinds of things you think someone can do in packaging where they don't need that basic knowledge of materials and containers and how they function.
I'm going to ask you, but my guess would be that apart from the physical characteristics, that is the density of the plastic, the nature of the plastics, etc., and being able to calculate risk-reward ratios, that most people, whether it be in the aesthetic design of it, whether it be in the physical utility design, user interface design, whether it be in the production supervision role, whether it be in the distribution of it role, whether it be in talking with potential customers to find their needs with regard to product testing, I would think you don't need any of that science and math. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I think you are.
Okay, go ahead.
Because if you have a product... So this is one of the ways that packaging typically interfaces with the rest of the company. The product people have this great new product, and they tell you we need a package for it. Mm-hmm. And the packaging professional has to understand the characteristics of the product and how to translate the protection that the product needs into the protection that the package has to provide in terms of things like how much oxygen, how good does it have to be at keeping oxygen out? Mm-hmm. How is it going to travel during the distribution cycle? How is the shape of the package going to impact the number of products that will fit in a truck and therefore influence the amount of fuel that will be used? They have to understand how consumers are likely to perceive this package. It's not just making it pretty. It's making it work. And to make it work, you have to understand all the aspects of the system from the people to the machinery to the trucks and everything else that's going to interface with that package. And that takes science.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. Good answer, Sue. My guest is Sue Selke. She is the director of the nationally prominent School of Packaging at Michigan State University. Well, certainly we're seeing that ever a larger percentage of purchases are made online. And I notice, you know, now, it used to be when I ordered online, I would get most things in a box. Now I get them in an absolutely, recycled gray bit of plastic with minimal packaging. So that's a very visible manifestation of how online purchasing is affecting packaging. Tell me, so is there any other way in which online purchasing is affecting packaging?
One of the other ways is that that package that you get has to be stronger than the package that you pick off the shelf in the store.
Right.
Because it is exposed to all these things during the shipping cycle pretty much on its own.
Right. Right, it makes perfect sense. I can see, right, the plastic that I used to be able to just tear open, now I have a pair of scissors near where I open packages because it's stronger plastic, and that makes all the sense in the world. Okay, now, I would think that you spend more than a few years in the world of packaging. I imagine that when you mentioned supermarket, when you walk in the supermarket and walk down the aisles, that is a cornucopia of packaging. What might you see as you walk down the aisles that I might not see as somebody who knows nothing about packaging?
Some of the things that I see are pretty subtle. So I may notice, for example, that my water bottle is thinner than it used to be.
Sure.
Or that those cheese pouches that I was talking about earlier are smaller than they were before. I don't think I always see things that a normal person wouldn't see. Maybe one of the biggest differences is when I go in a store, I tend to look at the packages not just for what I'm wanting to get, but also other things that just pop out at me and make me curious.
Well, definitely. So, yeah, well, definitely. Well, was there anything specific you wanted to say, or you want me to make a comment here?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. There's certainly a packaging thing that I have amazingly appreciated. I shop at Trader Joe's almost all the time, and a remarkable percentage of their packaging is pouches that are resealable. You know, no more do I have to fold it over and then it reopens to the air. I bought coffee. Now, coffee used to be in these big canisters. I bought 12 ounces of coffee. It was in a pouch. And when you can, you don't need a scissor, you tear off the top, and then it has one of those like Ziploc bag things underneath that, and some of them work better than others, but boy, does that save a lot of hassle. I think that's a wonderful, I imagine that the person who invented that will die in anonymity, but he or she has so improved the quality of zillions of people's lives. Do you get off on that like I just did?
Oh, yeah, I love reclosable packages. And what's kind of cool about that is that there are more and more different ways to give reclosability to packages. There didn't used to be.
Give me an example. What are two ways?
So, for example, I'm not going to go into specific brands because I might get it wrong, but cookies that come in little trays that are inside pouches.
Right.
You peel open the top, and then you just push it back down, and the adhesive sticks it again.
Right. You know, another little innovation I just thought about. I remember a few years ago reading that chewing gum actually increases your IQ. So 5 or 10 minutes before I go and do something important, like me being on the radio, I didn't do it this morning, but if being on the radio, I will chew gum. And there's this xylitol gum. It's what the hell is the name of that brand, the famous brand? But anyway, it's made with xylitol rather than some other artificial sweetener. And they now sell them in, like the way they used to sell medication, like drugs, each individual one where you just pop it open. There's no wrapper that has to be self-disposed. So there are 16 of these in one very convenient, small, little strip. And with almost no environmental waste and nothing to throw away, I'm able to simply with one hand take my teeth, break it with my teeth, goes in my mouth, it's effortless. That's a simple little thing, but I think, you know, it improves so many people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
What's one more that you use? Some packaging that you, Sue Selke, in your own life use that makes your life easier.
So one of my favorite things is the microwave-ready meals. I can pull one out of my freezer. Mm-hmm. Stick it back in the freezer at work. When I get there, when it's lunchtime, I pull it out and I pop it in the microwave. I think I eat healthier.
Healthier. Now, the normal stereotype is that those kind of prepackaged things are filled with chemicals or whatever. You know, I'm asking, this is not a leading question. Do you think the availability of these pre-prepared foods leads people to eat less local, organic, sustainable, healthy, and more chemicals?
Well, lots of the brands of these things now do have minimal chemical processing. They're That's why they're kept frozen, so they don't use a preservative. They're nothing like these things used to be, if you're thinking even 5 years ago, I'd say.
Okay. Let's bring this to a close. I always like, with all my guests whom I like, I tend to leave this as the final question. I don't know if you know this. I am a career counselor, and I've been one for a long time. And I've been doing on this radio program something called Workovers, where people call in with their work-related problem, their career problem. They could be unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy. They could have a problem with a coworker, a financial, you know, compensation issue or whatever. And so I like to give my guests an opportunity to be one of those. So let's say I was your career coach, your any aspect of your career. What would be the one problem that you would like to me to ask you a few questions about and then hopefully help you get it, come up with a baby step toward improving your work life?
Oh, gee, I love my job.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Everybody who I love my job too, doesn't mean there aren't issues.
Well, you know, I'm to the point where if the issues get bad enough, I can just retire.
Okay, let's go there. What are your musings, since you're of retirement age, you say, what are your musings about when you should and should not retire, and should you do it as a glide path, or should you do it all at once?
I think the main thing I think about is I'm serious about really loving what I do. I don't want to stay on doing it after if I get to the point where I'm not really contributing as much as I should be.
Do you get enough feedback to, you know, it's like when a baseball player, you know, it's kind of pathetic when they've been a great player their whole life and then they're still hanging on, they're hitting 200 and they're still hanging on, it's pathetic. But there is a concrete manifestation of their decline, that is they're hitting much worse, they're batting average. But in a subjective feel like the director of a packaging program at Michigan State, it's very subtle. Are you getting enough feedback to get a sense of when you'll know when you've crossed the line, whether a younger person might steward your very important department or your important school of packaging better?
I hope so. There are a couple people that I work with that I trust that I asked some time ago, you know, if that kind of thing happens, please tell me honestly.
What would you say there was one thing, you know, it's a myth that we talk, you know, the really good professionals are growing until the day they die, even after they retire. What's the area for growth that you want to get better at as a professional, Sue?
That's a great question. I'd say relating with other people.
In what context?
I tend to be, maybe you can't probably tell from this, but I tend to be kind of shy and quiet.
No, I believe that. I absolutely believe that. No, I'm just a pain in the butt, I know. So under what circumstances would you like to be less shy and quiet?
Speaking up for what I believe in cases where other people are saying things that aren't true or acting in ways that aren't helpful or being mean to other people.
Would this be in a faculty meeting kind of context?
No, not usually.
Okay.
There I speak up.
Yeah, good. Okay, so I'm trying to get something concrete. So where is the context in which if there was a god, the goddess, looking down upon Sue Selke, he would say, Sue, you should be speaking up in this context. Give me one example of without. I don't want you to reveal any. You know, certainly.
Yeah, when I'm in a group of people,
like at a professional conference, as an audience member,
conference, a party, you know, a gathering of some kind.
And do you care enough about that to actually say, okay, the next time at a gathering, and I'm either at a party and somebody's doing something that I disagree with. No one's saying you should always speak up. There are always times we say it's wise to be quiet. Not every battle is worth fighting. Absolutely correct. But let's assume let's take a professional. You're in the audience at a professional conference presentation, and you're tempted to speak up because you believe it's in the greater common good to do so. But heretofore, you have not done so. Is that a good context that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Great. So, what would the goddess within you? We all have a goddess within us, and we have a jerk within us. What would the goddess within you tell you at that moment to say that would give you the courage or the wisdom or whatever to speak up? A little mantra, almost.
I have no idea.
Is it enough to say that is a goal, that the next group event that you're in, I'm not asking you to guarantee that you should speak up, but
yeah,
to more neutrally ask yourself whether the goddess within you would speak up. Is that a reasonable takeaway?
Sure.
All right. I'll quit while I'm sort of ahead. Anyway, Sue Selke, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Namco. By the way, I want you to... So tell us just briefly about the master's program that would be the online master's program that would be relevant to my listeners here in California, as well as what your thoughts are about whether they should consider that or something at Cal Poly San Luis or anybody place else that's more accessible to us here in California.
So for our program, like I mentioned, you have to have the science and math background. Mm-hmm. We'll take mm-hmm. care of giving you the packaging specific stuff mm-hmm. after mm-hmm. as you start the program.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that that Caltech is going to start perhaps a similar type of program. I don't think it's up and running yet,
uh-huh.
so I really can't compare the two.
Okay. And how much does your online master's degree cost, really, total dollars out?
I have a really bad memory for figures. It's on a per-credit basis. If you don't have a packaging background,
right.
It's about 38 credits total. I think it's on the order of $900 a credit.
So that's about $35,000.
Yes, yeah, so that's why most of the people in that program, their employers are paying for it.
And it's a public institution, yep. Anyway, Sue, thank you very much for being my guest. I hope you found it interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, take care and be well.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. And now, my interest is you. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I like to lay out the parameters, for-profit, non-profit, government, 16 or 76, whether you're unemployed or well-employed, all that's required is you've got a problem. There's a certain unhappiness in your work life. I can usually help. And certainly the price is not $35,000, it's zero. The phone number here at Work with Marty Namco, NKALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Last week I was reading and then riffing on a few of my tweets. I do love to tweet, and I commend it to you. What a wonderful way to create a repository of your best ideas that you can go and look back at all the time. And also, it's an easy way to make a difference. If you have an insight, if you have an idea, you can immediately share it with you know, hundreds or thousands of people at minimal relative effort. Although it was, I think, Pascal who said, forgive me for writing such a long letter, I didn't have time to write a short one, but it usually doesn't take that long to come up with a tweet. So here are a few that I wrote recently that I think are worthy of your attention. 1900 to 1960, photogenic. 1960 to 2012, telegenic. 2014, social media genic, or for short, social genic. Indeed, social media really is an easy way to disseminate your ideas. If it's not 140 characters you can put on Twitter, whether it be Instagram, which just got bought for like 50 some enormous amount of money by I don't know, was it Google or Apple or somebody, or Facebook. By the way, those of you who don't know Instagram is unique in that you can make posts, and once it gets distributed to your people, it eliminates. So you can say things that you're not that comfortable having out there forever, and that's the advantage of Instagram. But you know, all of them. If you're graphically oriented, Pinterest. You know, certainly Facebook and LinkedIn if it's career oriented, or Twitter. Or your blog. Those are all social media vehicles, and they're a great way to disseminate ideas, to ask questions. If you want input, you know, social media, by the way, includes the forums. There's a forum on any imaginable topic on LinkedIn. Asking your question can get you, it's like getting the access to the wisdom of, you know, hundreds or thousands of people for free. So being social media genic is an important skill, especially for outreach, And certainly, it's obvious for salespeople. You know, it's a natural tool for trolling for customers without dialing for dollars. Okay, I got a whole lot more, but we've got calls on the line. I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So let's go to the phones. I guess we can. Yeah, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Marty.
Hi.
My name is Lin. I'm from Taiwan.
Uh-huh.
And my friend is listening to your radio station.
Okay.
And I got a couple questions, and hopefully I can talk with you. I'm a new makeup artist. My ability is yoga and makeup. But I have a problem to start with my career. I'm kind of wondering where to start it.
Okay, I want to make sure I understood what you said. So you're a makeup artist. You mentioned yoga. I don't understand the interaction between yoga and makeup artist.
Oh, because I'm doing better at art, in art. So I choose makeup, mm-hmm. artistry, and yoga is my second interest.
I see.
My second hobby. Yeah, so.
So let's talk about the makeup artist thing. Now, there are many niches where makeup artists do make a living. There are those who specialize in weddings. There are those who specialize in movies and theater. There are those who are special effects experts in makeup. My sister, frankly, became wealthy doing makeup. She went and bought her own line of makeup from the manufacturer. It's amazingly how cheap it is. The profit margins are, it's amazing what people will pay retail for makeup. And she simply rented space in a very busy salon that had people coming in for haircuts, and she offered makeovers there. And then eventually she just opened her own little shop called Let's Makeup, cute little pink shop, and she really made a lot of money. That's one niche. But so that's my little brain dump. Do any of those areas within makeup appeal to you?
Yes, a little. I went through some training. I took some courses in Taiwan and here. Mm-hmm. And but I I'm kind of nervous.
I
forgot what to say.
Okay. Well,
my parents. I talked to my parents this morning, and they kind of disappointed that I just want to find a cosmetic company position to sell the product from the basic employees. Then I wish I can do the makeup artist.
Let me interrupt you. My first take, my take on this is that short term, to get some experience, it would not hurt you to be a makeup artist in Macy's or whatever, where there is high volume. So you can learn a lot more. And I would focus, given that you're from Taiwan, we always try to build on what we have as an extra advantage. You speak Chinese. You understand probably to a better extent than a non-Chinese person what Chinese tastes are in makeup, than skin tone and different issues. So I would encourage you to get a job at a very busy department store that has a heavily Chinese, of course not exclusively, but a heavily Chinese customer base. Or, as my sister did, find a haircutting place that serves a heavily Chinese market, for starters, and then see if they will let you have a little corner where you're doing makeovers for people. That really does, it yields a lot of advantages to the firm, to the haircutting place, because it would bring in some customers. Instead of them sitting and waiting and having to read a magazine, they may get a makeover, and I would recommend doing it for free, the makeovers, but then charging them for the cosmetics that you use. That's what my sister did. And then when you feel you've gotten enough confidence, either from working at a Macy's or whatever, then if you wanted to, you could focus on some niche, like, for example, wedding, Chinese weddings. and then work perhaps alongside a photographer who does weddings, especially for Chinese people, and say, I could be the makeup artist for your wedding party. Does any of that sound valuable to you?
Yes, and I'm trying to do some makeup with the local photographer.
Good.
Yes.
Exactly. But where the money is, you know, it's amazing. I was just listening to Philosophy Talk before, and they talked about, you know, marriage being the last vestiges of, you know, property holding. I don't know if I'd go that far. But still, people spend a fortune on weddings. And, you know, it's their special day. And they spend, you know, they have no money, but they'll spend $50,000 on a wedding, and they will therefore spend a lot on the photographer and even the makeup artist. So I would encourage you to find a photographer that specializes in weddings and Chinese weddings, because again, that's where you've got an advantage, and that will teach you a lot about that little niche. And who knows, you could become the preeminent, and you want to be artistic, the preeminent Chinese wedding photographer. That's my best advice.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to take, we've got other calls, so I'm going to leave you. I know you said you had other questions, but I want to leave it at that for today. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. Work with Marty Emko. Good luck. All right. Phone number here. Work with Marty Emko. If you have a workover, whether you not a makeup makeover, but a workover, I only will pummel you if I think it really serves your best interest. You know, workover without fists, but. Whatever your work-related problem, I can usually help. The phone number here at KELW and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. How can I help you?
Hi there. I am at kind of a turning point. I was in Portland, Oregon, as a research assistant for about 20 years in academics. Managing a bibliographical database and taking notes, doing library research and copying, that kind of thing. But I've worked, since I moved here, for the last 9 years, I've been working with kids as a nanny. I want to get back into, I applied for a job in records management, and they're going to test me, and I want help learning what to study up on. It's for the city of Berkeley. So I was wondering if you could help with that. And then I have another completely different option that might...
Now, reference management, I'm assuming that means an understanding of the various reference options that are online and print. Is that correct?
Records management.
Oh, records management. Okay. Because I know nothing about records management, let alone the exam, I would do two things. I would Google City of Berkeley Records Management Exam to see if anybody's taken them and posted their experience on a forum or online. And then I would simply Google records management and read a few of the top, the first search results that Google's algorithm comes up with. So you will learn latest best practices. Does that make sense?
That's what I've been doing. I've been doing the latter. I will do the former as well.
One other thing, by the way, before we get to your other question. Very often, they're more than happy to tell you a certain amount of information. Have you contacted the contact person for that job and say, what can you tell me about the exam? I want to be like a good employee. I want to be prepared. I don't want you to not ask for the answers to the test. But what would you recommend that I focus on? That can often be very helpful. Have you thought about doing that?
Well, I emailed a couple of people that might be able to answer that kind of question, but I will call them as well. I'll try to,
Just a thought.
I have a good friend, actually, who wants to do a cannabis extract startup.
Right.
Apparently, a lot of the current extracts available are tainted with butane, which is the extraction solvent. And my friend wants to do something that doesn't use butane, that's totally pure, and I'm wondering if you know anything about whether or not this could be a startup worth betting on and investing a lot of time and energy.
Two thoughts. If it's something that's patentable, he should really try to protect it, You know, that would, if it really has it, if he just has a concept, gee, I'd like to develop something that's more organic and doesn't use the butane, that's nothing. You know, if he's got enough of the science technology background, I'm always a fan of doing, you know, the minimum I can and then selling the technology to somebody who's got the power to make it happen, to produce it. Because if he goes and he does his stupid startup, and I don't mean stupid, but I mean a startup, he's, you know, if it's any good, he'll get swallowed up by the big guys. I'd rather see him just get as far as proof of technology, demonstrate that it works at least to some extent, and then sell it to a big entity. Now, that said, I wanted to start by being value neutral so I can be of help. I am privileged to have done a review of the literature on marijuana's effects for Time magazine, and also interviewed the head of the Obama administration's National Institutes of Drug Abuse on this very topic, and I've just thoroughly read the National Academies of Science. This last month has just produced a meta-evaluation that is a review of 200 different, more than 200 different major studies related to marijuana. Marijuana is far, and I want to underline the word far, more dangerous than the mainly tobacco industry-backed advocates would have us believe. Not just memory, not just motivation, but weakens the heart, increases the likelihood of psychotic episodes, and increased cancer risk. So I understand that the nation is moving, and with the media fueling it, toward national legalization, and we're certainly going to be ever more legal here. But I urge you from a cosmic justice perspective to say no. Just like tobacco is legal, we don't need any more anything that would encourage people to. I've seen as a career counselor the huge pain and decrement to people's lives from lack of motivation that they will admit comes from pot. They just don't care.
Okay. Well, there are I think you're referring to the psychoactive properties, which if you look back at the research that you've reviewed, I'm guessing that that a lot of that product that was used in those studies was psychoactive inducing product, which the heat activates those psychoactive properties. But if you extract the medicinal factors without heat, then there's no psychoactive properties whatsoever.
Off topic, and I think it's not true. I asked her about vaping, for example.
Right, but I feel like it's got to be
nope.
You just said it has power, and it needs
it does.
To be balanced. So.
Well, it's balanced against conjecture, and this is something that has been studied again and again in many, many, many forms, smoking or vaping. And vaping, according to the national, again, the Obama, not some right-wing, right Republican reefer madness people, according to both the National Academy of Sciences and the Obama administration's head of National Institute of Drug Abuse, vaping, for example, is more dangerous because of the high concentrations. But it's off topic. I'm required to stay on work, but I could not ethically.
Well, that's heat as well.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, it's always a delicate balance. I mean, I could not sleep at night if she's asking for somebody to. She's asking about how can we create this new pot product that doesn't use butane without ethically at least. And I'm really just trying to stay on facts. And you, please, dear listeners, because I care about you more than you realize, I urge you to Google National Academy of Sciences. This is not some political organization. It's not funded by Big Tobacco. Google National Academy of Sciences pot evaluation. Google pot and the word NEMCO, and you'll see I reviewed hundreds, dozens of major studies, not produced by advocates, but by Harvard and Northwestern. And then Google NEMCO and Nora Volkow. She is the Obama administration's head of National Drug Abuse. Read on your own. I've smoked pot. I'm not some perfect person, but my eyes have been open recently because of this, and I don't want to take any calls about marijuana. I do want to help you with your career. Welcome to Work with Marty. We're going right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, my name is Mark.
Hello, Mark.
I wanted to ask you a quick question. My wife and I, my daughter graduated a couple years ago from USF with a degree in dance.
Right.
And she did really well. And she also had a degree in sociology.
Right.
She did very well, but now she's working as in a burger
right.
joint.
Right.
Nice. And now she's worried. So, but one of the things that my wife keeps bringing up is my daughter is getting tattoos. Now, it's not crazy, but they're visible. Mm-hmm. And my wife feels that this is a hindrance when she's interviewing. And I don't know anymore, and it is causing friction. I wondered what your opinion is on interviewing where you have visible tattoos.
That's where I take a more liberal stance. The society has changed. When I was growing up, tattoos were a sign of somebody who's really was screwed up. It has become quite mainstream. And especially in the kind of fields that, you know, she would want to work in, related to sociology, these are very, quote, the word is progressive or liberal, whatever you want to say, tend to be progressive environments. And in fact, if she's applying for a job in which she's at all working with people who are progressive, who, you know, sociology tends to be focused on people working with who are vulnerable or whatever, that may signal, you know, we all send social signals by what we wear, our hair, or whatever. I'm not convinced that given the kind of world that she would likely want to be employed in, whether that's a negative. And especially when there's a natural tendency for parents to, for kids to rebel, adult children to rebel, mm-hmm. I would not make that the mountain on which I would climb. I would make the mountain, be in a lovely, supportive way, but firm way, seeing if I could help her develop a really good strategy for getting employed in the kind of job that she would like, unless she really wants to. There's nothing wrong about waiting tables your whole life. You are serving, it is ethical, but if that's not where she was meant to be, and I'm sure you spent a fortune on USF, on her dance and her sociology, if that's not where she's meant to be, then I would, the role as a parent, I would be a kind of a loving taskmaster in helping her develop and execute on a plan to help her achieve her potential that she wants to achieve. But I wouldn't fight on the tattoos. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Thank you. One more quick question.
Yes.
It wouldn't be fair unless I didn't bring in my son, a question about my son.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, real quick.
Sure. No, it's fine. You're good.
He's been talking about doing data coding.
Right.
And yet I've been hearing comments about coding is now in the past because the technology has moved beyond writing basic code, that there's toolkits now. So, and I've heard of things called data science and things like that. What is coding now gone? Is it past?
No, coding is not gone at all. There are certainly better tools. It used to be 20 or 30 years ago, the coding was done in what was called a very low level, which means assembly language, bits and bytes, zeros and ones. There were ever more sophisticated kind of, what's the word they're called? They used to call them macros, but little subroutines that can be used to make it easier to program.
Right.
It's not going anywhere. The dangers in coding and programming in languages is you've always got to be learning the new language. You know, Ruby on Rails, you know, is and Python, rather than just, you know, certainly basic. Or certainly Fortran,
I remember those from way back. Yes.
Right, but even C is becoming a little bit not as it's used. But you've got to stay up on the latest languages. And the big sword of Damocles is offshoring, because any work product that can be sent over the internet can be done cheaply and sometimes more motivationally and without all the employee benefits of, you know, workers' compensation and wrongful termination suits and increased social security limits by having it done in China or India or Israel or Ireland. And so the risk really is that it's a global race to the bottom, and the compensation could be crappy unless he's really good. Now, data science, I want to make a brief comment about that. There's no question. That, for the last 3 to 4 years, has been the holy grail. Data scientists, people who can know how to use SQL, something called SQL, Query SQL, which is a program that helps you extract data from these enormous data sets, like all people's Facebook usage or Amazon usage or whatever, to extract reasonable information on how to better market or for nonprofits to do a better job of pitching fat cats. It is a hugely in demand and will not likely go away, but it also attracts some of the smartest people on the planet. And so the competition, while there's a lot of jobs, the people who get the good jobs are pretty damn smart. And some even those, you know, there are these boot camps, these coding boot camps that are very popular now. But even graduates of those are viewed askance unless they show beyond what their project at the end of the boot camp is, that they've got expertise beyond. So it's a very competitive field, especially in the Bay Area, the epicenter for coding.
A friend of mine told me about how her friend's son had finished a data science boot camp in Berkeley, but he was an engineer. He had an engineering degree before he ever started. So he did well, and a Norwegian company came in and hired him. There's a lot of European companies coming in and hiring these people. But, yeah. Okay, great.
Yes. I like to stay up on tech. It's kind of, I'm naturally technology-oriented. But as I, you know, if, just a broad brush kind of statement that one can make, you know, to broad listening, I'm worried about anything that isn't high touch, where it's something that has to be done locally, because I really do I do worry about the automation of things, that anything that can be sent on the internet. So in the end, and I also I see people who are happy and not happy in careers. Haircutters, that can't be offshored. You know, makeup artists, you know, plumbers. Some of them
are
the happiest.
Service.
Yeah, they're some of the happiest people I know, because they're providing a service where they succeed with nearly every customer. It's not offshore. It doesn't require you to spend forever in front of a computer. You're getting to move around a lot. And because we have, in my mind, crazily prioritized science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM fields, and college degrees, that there is a relative shortage of the good plumber, electrician, haircutter, etc. And so I would invite, unless your son is a star, I would encourage him to think about, go beyond the standard conventional STEM paths or coding, unless he really, if he's gifted at it, of course, that's fine. A gifted
right.
person's going to always succeed. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Speaking of help, my longtime engineer board operator had a potential idea for the woman who had her degree in dance, Mark's guy, which is dance therapy is being used for seniors. She's suggesting that there are studies that show that dancing is effective in staving off dementia. And I would think that's probably true of all exercise. Exercise increases oxygenation to the brain, which is very key to avoiding dementia. So it perhaps that offers a bit of hope to Mark, which I probably should have said while he was still on the air, but hopefully he was still listening. Anyway, I have time for just 1 minute worth of tips. As I said, I've been interspersing calls with tweets that I have written. A couple on procrastination. A truly top expert on procrastination, he's written a ton of books, he privately told me in a phone call, he said, Marty, procrastination is incurable. So maybe you should accept your procrastination as a mere minus. We all have minuses, even if you're very successful. And coincidentally, John Perry, who is the co-host of Philosophy Talk, he's written a book called The Art of Procrastination. And it is a humorous book, but it's about accepting it. John Perry, who's achieved a great deal of success as an eminent professor at Stanford, nonetheless acknowledges he's a big-time procrastinator. So instead of, you know, there's endless articles written on, you know, how to overcome procrastination. If you've tried everything under the sun, maybe this is time to say, you know what, that's just one of my minuses. Just like Marty Nemko is one of his, I'm very intense. I've tried to be calmer by nature. I will never be calm. I care tremendously about making a difference, but I'm too intense. And you know, probably just in the last 6 months, I decided I'm just going to accept myself as who I am. It's one of my warts. Like, I'm bald. I wish I had a full head of hair, but I'm not. I'm not going to wear some toupee. So maybe the good way to end today's show is inviting you to do a measure of self-acceptance. Decide what you can change, what you're unlikely to change, and go forth and do good with what you got. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I'm going to talk with, I did a lot of research to find who I think is the most effective expert on negotiation I could find. I love this guy. He's not a softy, but he's not too tough, and he's very subtle, really smart guy. We're going to talk about how to negotiate both smart and lovingly, a word that's not used very often. Seth Freeman. Anyway, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Go to martynemko.com for the archive of his articles and information on his 8 books, including the just-published second edition of his latest, The Best of Marty Nemko. That's Marty, NEMKO.com. Join him next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko on 90.